must be special thanks to Becca Stelly, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick. Wear a mask. I'm Amy Goodman.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a fourth day in a row of record-shattering new COVID-19 cases in Oregon, as schools try to find new ways to keep students and staff safe. A candidate for governor in Oregon is told he does not meet the qualifications to run. And members of an Oregon group speak out about how cities can protect themselves from another riot like the deadly event last January 6th. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 6th, 2022. I'm Annette Newell, so glad to have you with us. The new Omicron COVID variant is spreading with record speed. Today, Oregon recorded another record high new coronavirus case number, 7,615. That marks the fourth day in a row of shattering previous high marks. Hospitals also reported their biggest uptick in weeks, with 588 people needing care after testing positive. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has more on how our local schools are trying to cope.
Portland schools are reverting to COVID safety protocols originally introduced last spring for extracurricular activities amid growing cases of the Omicron variant. With students returning from winter break, a new wave of cases propelled by Omicron has caused Portland public schools to return to past COVID-19 safety measures for student athletes and performers, according to an announcement released on Tuesday. For those participating in extracurricular activities, masks must be worn at all times, including during rehearsals, competitions, and performances, with exceptions allowed for musicians playing wind instruments. PPS says these reintroduced measures will remain in place until at least February 4th, where infection rates will determine their possible extension. Additional restrictions apply to access to locker rooms and a temporary ban on overnight travel for athletic competitions or performances. Concession stands will remain closed during extracurricular activities, and spectators aged 5 and up will be required to show proof of full vaccination or provide a negative COVID test result within 72 hours. PPS says it intends to remain flexible to modifying these measures based on current health data and medical guidelines. On Wednesday, the district also started its Test to Stay program, which allows asymptomatic, unvaccinated students who may have been exposed to COVID-19 at school or on the bus to remain in school once a negative test result is provided. PPS officials also noted that the district will be offering COVID testing at its district office to asymptomatic teachers who think they may have been exposed. Brenda Martinek, Chief of Student Support Services for PPS summed up the recent measures, saying, quote, "Our whole priority is to make sure that we are taking care of our students and staff and keeping kids in school," end quote. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
One Democratic hopeful for Oregon governor does not qualify for the job, according to Oregon Secretary of State Shamia Fagan. KBOO's Josh Salem explains.
The Oregon Elections Division has declared Nicholas Kristof may not run for governor of Oregon. That conclusion was based on grounds he does not meet the residency requirement for eligibility under the Oregon Constitution. Kristof, a former New York Times columnist and reporter, announced last October that he would run for Oregon governor as a Democrat. He has no direct political experience, but stated he could make a difference on homelessness, education, and jobs. Oregon's constitution requires a gubernatorial candidate to have resided within the state for 3 years before an election. Kristof's attorney stated in August of 2021 that he met the eligibility requirements and could run, based on the premise he grew up in Oregon, owns a farm and residential property in Yamhill County, and has called Oregon his home in his writings. He listed his occupation in a recent campaign filing as a journalist, author, and farmer. Kristof voted as a New York resident in the November 2020 general election and registered to vote in Oregon in December of that year. New York law does not require a prospective voter to register in the jurisdiction of their principal residence. On that basis, the attorneys argued he was a legal resident of both states, even though he was registered to vote in New York. The Oregon Elections Division concluded Kristof does not meet the eligibility requirement and that he may not run for or serve as Oregon governor. Oregon Secretary of State Shamia Fagan said Thursday, quote, "The rules are the rules, and they apply equally to all candidates for office in Oregon. I stand by the determination of the experts in the Oregon Elections Division that Mr. Kristof does not currently meet the constitutional standards," end quote. Kristof can appeal the ruling and is expected to do so. He has already raised more than $1 million in campaign support. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Meantime, another candidate, House Speaker Tina Kotek, announced today she is stepping down from her leadership position before the February legislative session as she runs for governor in the May primary election. A year ago today, rioters stormed America's Capitol, trying to overthrow the 2020 election. Five people died as a result. A new report from an Oregon-based organization explores ways that cities can defend themselves against anti-democracy forces. Eric Tegedoff talks to a director from the Western States Center.
It's been 1 year since the storming of the Capitol in Washington, D.C., and an Oregon-based group has released a report on how local governments can push back on the anti-democratic movement that has grown in the wake of the attack, including in Oregon. The Western State Center's new report explores ways city leaders can strengthen themselves, especially as white nationalists and paramilitary groups gain traction. Lindsay Schubiner with the group says animus has been directed at local government officials.
It's really dangerous. Threats and intimidation and political violence undermine the democratic process and can make it much more difficult for communities to participate in that process.
Schubiner says local officials are on the front lines of countering these violent movements. The report says local officials have to be clear about the rejection of bigotry and other authoritarian movements. Schubiner says communities need to build broad coalitions against anti-democratic forces.
That's one of the most important things that local leaders can do, is build the political will to directly denounce bigotry and anti-democracy movements and work to defend inclusive democratic institutions.
She says communities also should make sure these institutions are more inclusive in the first place. Schubner says other levels of government should help in this effort as well.
I'd also like to see much more support for the local level from state and federal institutions committed to defending inclusive democracy. It's important that we not leave local government alone, whether that's from the federal level or the state level or the community level.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Meantime, in another western state, a group has been warning of a far-right rally to mark January 6th. Eric Tegedoff also talked to a group in Montana, the but says January 6th should be a day of reflection, not supporting people who broke into Congress.
While vigils are planned in Montana to mark the January 6th Capitol riot aimed at overthrowing the results of the 2020 election, far-right extremists have scheduled a rally in Helena. A group known as the People's Rights Network says it will gather at the state capitol in support of people who were arrested because of the attack in Washington, D.C. 1 year ago. The organization was launched by anti-government activist Ammon Bundy. Travis McAdam is with the Montana Human Rights Network.
The organizers are really framing it as sort of this prayer vigil to remember what they're calling political prisoners. But the rest of us would call those people the insurrectionists that stormed the Capitol.
The Capitol attack resulted in 5 deaths and more than 130 injuries among police officers. To date, federal prosecutors have charged more than 700 people with storming the Capitol, including 5 from Montana. McAdam says his group takes the opposite view of January 6th from that of the organizers of the rally in Helena.
January 6th should be a day of thoughtful reflection about how so many people were incited to violence and incited to essentially try to overthrow the government, and thinking about how we can prevent something like that from happening in the future.
On the other end of the spectrum, candlelight vigils are being held across the country, including in Bozeman and Great Falls, to condemn the attacks on the Capitol and call for action to protect democracy. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Portland City Council has rescinded a nearly $12 million award to a local nonprofit that had proposed goals of carrying out life-saving work. The council cites past financial misdeeds and discrepancies on projects. Wednesday's unanimous vote cited the group Diversifying Energy's executive director, Linda Woodley, for defrauding energy companies, racking up millions of dollars in liens for unpaid federal and state taxes, including an $810,000 penalty filed earlier this year, and for time served in prison. They say Woodley has also allegedly fabricated parts of her professional background in her firm's proposal to Portland's Clean Energy Fund. It's a new tax-funded program aimed at providing money to nonprofits seeking to reduce carbon emissions, create jobs, and promote resiliency. The program's poised to help those facing the most severe impacts from climate change, with a focus on helping Portlanders of color. It prioritizes funding for historically marginalized communities. Wednesday's decision paves the way for a different Portland-based organization, Earth Advantage, to lead an urgent city initiative to buy, store, and arrange for others to install 15,000 cooling units. Earth Advantage says it will work with community groups to ensure the cooling units will go to homes whose low-income residents are most at risk for deadly heat waves, like last June's that took the lives of at least 62 people in Multnomah County alone. This newly approved agreement will also free up roughly $1.5 million available for other projects to fight climate change and help promote well-being among Portland's vulnerable communities. City officials vowed that in the event of awarding Diversifying Energy as a potentially large misstep, they will better vet firms who apply not only for grants from the city's Clean Energy Fund, but for city grants more broadly. Mayor Ted Wheeler says, quote, "We need to learn from mistakes that are made. This was a potentially large one that was averted." A possible strike looms of municipal workers in Portland, which could impact the city's ability to provide basic services. About 1,200 employees and 6 unions could file an intention to strike within days, and they could strike 10 days after giving that notice. This comes after more than a year of bargaining. Negotiations with the city have deadlocked over a contract affecting plumbers, painters, machinists, and other trade unions. The unions say the city is not keeping up with Portland's cost of living. Meantime, labor leaders are also concerned about the Biden administration's Build Back Better Act after Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia said he would not vote for the bill. As Emily Scott reports, some leaders say they're worried about the future of proposals in that legislation that they think are key to rebuilding manufacturing.
The future of the Build Back Better Act may be in doubt in Congress, but New York labor leaders say the bill would create sustainable union jobs and make key reforms that support working families. The $1 trillion Build Back Better Act proposes $110 billion to help spur the creation of new clean energy technology and supply chains, such as solar and batteries. Christian Gonzalez with the Industrial Division of the Communication Workers of America says clean energy jobs would greatly benefit New Yorkers and parts of the state that have seen job loss in the manufacturing sector.
Schenectady, New York used to have 30,000 workers at GE. So companies like GE have a unique opportunity to bring that work back and create these good, sustaining union jobs that would help reboost the U.S. manufacturing economy as well as New York's manufacturing economy.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has promised a vote on Build Back Better in the coming weeks. But resistance from Senator Joe Manchin and others has left the timeline up in the air. Manchin has been a vocal critic of some Build Back Better provisions, such as four-week paid family leave and universal preschool for 3- and 4-year-olds, citing their price tags when he said he can't support the legislation. Gonzalez says he thinks these policies should be seen instead as a major investment in working families.
You look at New York State and how many essential employees in the pandemic. There isn't adequate childcare. Build Back Better can help alleviate some of the tension that comes with not being able to have the medical care and leave that you need to provide for a new child or a family member.
The Build Back Better framework will allow New York to expand access to free high-quality preschool to nearly 300,000 additional 3- and 4-year-olds per year. I'm Emily Scott with New York News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on an Oregon symphony musician turned painter showing an exhibition. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. At 7, we've got Hard Knock Radio. Then at 8, listen to Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, rainy and getting windy overnight. A low down to 47. Expect about a quarter inch of rain. Tomorrow's weather, more rain and a high of 49. A flood advisory is in effect till Friday at 4 p.m. and a flood watch till Friday at 6 p.m. So look out for flooding of small streams and creeks and ponding in urban areas in Northwest Oregon and Southwest Washington. Remember, turn around and don't drown when you encounter flooded roads. Most flooding deaths happen in vehicles. We could see a peak of sunshine breakthrough for the weekend, though. On Saturday and Sunday, it looks like things will dry out and we will be in the high 40s. Today in history, on this date in 1838, Samuel Morse unveiled the telegraph, revolutionizing communication using electric impulses to transmit messages long distance over wires. And our quote of the day is from Samuel Morse, who said, "Every child has a dream to pursue the dream in every child's hand to make it a reality. One's invention is another's tool." Keeping wages lower actually be bad for business? That's the question labor leaders in North Dakota are asking. The state's minimum wage is still at $7.25 an hour, while nearby Montana, South Dakota, and Minnesota have minimums closer to $10. Mike Moen takes a look.
The start of the new year saw a number of states boost their minimum wage, but not North Dakota. Labor leaders say it's remained at $7.25 an hour for far too long, especially with neighboring states continuing to go higher. South Dakota, Montana, and Minnesota rang in the new year with higher minimum wages, with those increases tied to inflation. Cooper Caraway of the South Dakota Federation of Labor says not only does it put more money in the hands of workers and their families, but it helps to keep jobs filled.
Since the minimum wage was increased and tied to inflation, South Dakota's always had one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. And the good thing is that we also have a robust labor movement, and that robust labor movement is raising wages much higher than the minimum wage.
South Dakota's latest increase, the result of a voter-approved measure in 2014, brought its wage to $9.95 an hour. In North Dakota, worker advocates fear residents will abandon the state, even with jobs available, because the lower threshold will make it harder to survive. Last year, North Dakota lawmakers rejected a proposed hike, with concerns raised about the impact on businesses. Landis Larson of the North Dakota AFL-CIO says what's frustrating is that cost of living measures are pretty similar in the four-state region. He says that gives North Dakota policymakers no excuse for not taking action.
They really want to do their best to make a friendly business climate, but they forget about the worker climate. It's a two-way street.
State Representative Lori Beth Hager was behind last year's plan to increase North Dakota's minimum wage. The Fargo Democrat says being far behind other states is especially troubling right now.
When you look at the increases in housing costs and fuel costs and grocery costs, all of those things are exponentially rising and the minimum wage is just bottomed out.
Hager says a more likely scenario in which North Dakota increases its wage is by taking it to the voters, but other supporters say such a plan has to be tied to inflation. Mike Moen, Prairie News Service.
America marks the anniversary of one of its darkest days. The Attorney General promises to hold all January 6 suspects accountable for their actions. And Republican U.S. Senate Leader Mitch McConnell from Kentucky accuses Democrats of using January 6 to push voting reforms. With the stories affecting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Freedom! Freedom! Now, effectively a riot.
Today marks the anniversary of the January 6 attack at the U.S. Capitol when supporters of former President Trump stormed the building in an attempt to stop the certification of the 2020 presidential election. More than 140 police officers were injured, and rioters caused an estimated $1.5 million in damages. On the Senate floor Wednesday, Maryland Democrat Ben Cardin called it one of the nation's darkest days.
January the 6th, like December the 7th and September the 11th, is a date which will live in infamy.
More than 740 people have been charged, and Attorney General Merrick Garland says the Justice Department is committed to holding all suspects accountable.
As long as it takes, and whatever it takes, for justice to be done consistent with the facts and the law.
Federal officials say they've seen an uptick in calls for violence leading up to the anniversary, including increased threats made toward politicians. But others are calling for unity. Dozens of January 6th Day of Remembrance and Action events are scheduled across the country, including Columbus, Ohio. Mindy Hedges is an activist and organizer there.
It is not about parties. It is about our freedom. It is about our democracy, and it's about us as Americans.
Back in D.C., President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris will lead a day of memorial events, including lawmakers sharing their experience of the assault and a candlelight vigil at the National Mall. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell accused Democrats of using the anniversary to change filibuster rules to get voting rights bills passed.
The fact that violent criminals broke the law does not entitle Senate Democrats to break the Senate. It is surreal to hear sitting senators invoke January the 6th to justify, listen to this, to justify breaking rules to grab outcomes they have not earned.
House Democrats have passed two voting bills, but they've stalled in the Senate. The American Medical Association is criticizing the CDC's updated COVID isolation guidelines for not including a testing requirement. However, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky says a negative antigen test doesn't fully indicate the absence of transmissible virus. And she noted a person does not need a booster to be fully vaccinated.
Individuals are considered fully vaccinated against COVID-19 if they've received their primary series. That definition is not changing.
CDC will be using the term, quote, up-to-date, unquote, to encourage people to get boosters. Meanwhile, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki says the president supports all school districts staying open for face-to-face instruction.
And he agrees with medical, scientific, and education experts that because of the historic work we've done, we are more than equipped to ensure schools are open.
Chicago schools are shut down amid a dispute with the teachers' union over COVID safety protocols. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Tribal leader Aaron Payment publicly lashes out against the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians board of directors censuring him, and the Canadian government announces details of its plan to spend $40 billion for child welfare compensation and reform. We have these and more stories in today's edition of National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Shirley Jihad, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians chairperson Aaron Payment is lashing out against his tribe's board of directors. He says they're violating the tribe's constitution and open meetings laws. Native News Online reports his comments come after payment was formally censured by the board. The reasons for that have not been made public. The board removed him from all committees, both within tribal government and outside the tribe, that pertain to his tribal membership. Payment tells Native News Online the board's actions amount to, in his words, nothing short of a coup. Payment recently was re-elected chairperson by a wide margin. The news outlet reports the board's motion authorizes the executive director and legal counsel to hire an outside firm to investigate and address the chairperson's conduct. Payment also serves as recording secretary for the National Congress of American Indians after serving two terms as its vice president. The Canadian government has released the details of its $40 billion agreement in principle for First Nations child welfare compensation and reform. Dan Karpinchuk reports Native leaders say now it's up to Ottawa to live up to its end of the deal.
The federal government says it will provide $20 billion to Native children on reserve who were unnecessarily taken from their homes between 1991 and March of this year. There will also be compensation for those impacted and for children who didn't receive essential public services from 1991 to the end of 2007. The other $20 billion will be spent over 5 years on the reform of the First Nations Child and Family Services Program. And there will be money for young Native adults moving out of the child welfare system and for mechanisms to keep children at home in their communities. Cindy Blackstock is the executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. She says it could be a good deal if it's implemented.
Right now, it's words on paper. It's non-binding. And so what we need to do is see the government actually implement these measures to stop the ongoing discrimination, and also, really important, to make sure it never happens again to another generation of kids.
The agreement is still contingent on the approval of the Federal Court of Canada and the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. Both had ruled that Ottawa had discriminated against First Nations children. Native leaders say more than 200,000 Native children and their families are affected by the agreement. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Alaska's tribal leaders say they have collected enough signatures now for a ballot initiative asking voters whether the tribes should receive state recognition. The group Alaskans for Better Government is leading the initiative effort, and Alaska Public Media reports that group plans to submit those signatures to the state in mid-January for verification. Advocates of the ballot initiative say state recognition of the 229 tribes recognized federally would establish a symbolic government-to-government relationship. They tell Alaska Public Media the state recognition won't cost anything and will instead open the door to more federal dollars. Leaders of the ballot effort say Indigenous people in Alaska have waited long enough to be viewed as equals in the eyes of the state government. Leaders decided to take the issues directly to voters after legislation called the Alaska Tribal Recognition Act got stalled in the state Senate. And since October, canvassers have been out gathering signatures for the ballot initiative. Nearly half of all tribes recognized by the federal government are based in Alaska. Tribal leaders tell Alaska Public Media it is fundamentally wrong that they are not recognized by the state's government. For National Native News, I'm Shirley Jahad.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 6, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Josh Salem, Eric Tegedoff, Caitlin Backus, and Mike Moen. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us for the KBOO Evening News. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, we invite you to go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
There are many different ways one can respond to tragedy. For one artist, tragedy introduced different forms of expression. We got to chat with professional violinist and painter Randall Vimmer about his gallery of 40 paintings being displayed at Art Reach Gallery. The show will begin with a reception on Thursday, January 6th from 6 to 8 p.m. and will be open to the public up until March 27th, Tuesday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m.
So first of all, can you just go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Randall Vimmer, and I'm a former Oregon Symphony musician turned artist and painter.
So what started you as a musician? What got you interested in becoming a musician?
Well, basically, I grew up on a small farm in Missouri, and my mother handed me a violin when I was 10 years old, and the rest is history.